you know, what choice do you have? You can't put it in the water, you can't pull the power. So I thought, well, let's see what this mole can really do. And I'm heading towards rock and bush, building up airspeed, and just at the right moment, I give the yoke a yank.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 46 of On The Step With That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On The Step is all about float planes and flying boats. Could you imagine Santa's sleigh with a set of Whipline 8750s underneath? That's right, folks. It's that time of the year. Merry Christmas to you all. Hope everyone has had a great day with their friends and families. Did anyone get any seaplane-related gifts? A new paddle, maybe? A life jacket? A prepaid fuel card? Now, there's an idea. Maybe even a Mallard calendar? Still got a fair few of those left. How about a seaplane holiday? Did anyone out there get a venture out on their private seaplane for the festive season? Get in contact and tell me your seaplane-related Christmas presents and events, folks. My email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. All I want for Christmas, folks, is a 5-star Apple Podcast written review from all of you out there. I got a great review from @SamuKira in Canada last week titled Great Content, and he said, "This is awesome. Short but sweet, SamuKira, but very much appreciated," and that's all you have to say, folks. 100 written reviews are the goal, and we are now up to 65, so be like SamuKira and hop on to it. Merry Christmas to those On The Step patrons, including this week's new patron, Tim Langton. Tim is the chief pilot of Bridger Aerospace in the United States, taking command of the CL-415 EAF, or Enhanced Aerial Firefighter, Water Scoopers, alongside our recent guest and fellow patron, Al Hymers. Thanks, Tim, for joining as a Super Cub tier member. It's great to have the support of industry leaders such as yourself backing the show. For those wanting to join the growing group of patrons supporting On The Step, the link is in the show notes below. Special shout out to the Grumman Mallard tier members Sean Fowler and Alex Fisher, who contribute $25 a month to everyone's favourite seaplane podcast. Merry Christmas, fellas. Also, a very Merry Christmas should go to Steve McCaughey and the team at the Seaplane Pilots Association. I'm in regular contact with Steve, and I can tell you this, folks, there is no one working harder for our industry than this guy. He told me on the phone recently he has not had a day off for 10 weeks. Please, Steve, enjoy your Christmas break with Mary and your little cub and take a break. You deserve it. The SBA has been a big supporter of the podcast, and I'm very much looking forward to working with them into the future. If you're after more seaplane podcast content, check out Steve and Abby's Waterflying podcast. They just got a great episode with Chuck Whiplinger, CEO of Whipair. Great stuff, guys. And if anyone wants to say thanks to Steve and the crew at SPA, check out the link in the show notes for a discounted membership for On The Step fans. Okay, folks, on to today's guest. Santa Claus was unavailable this time of the year, but instead, I've got on the line a fella who brought joy all year round to those in the Bahamas for over 20 years, flying his Mall seaplane with those famous registrations C6 Wet and C6 C. Now retired, Paul Harding has released a book all about his incredible life in paradise titled Sharks in the Runway, and he joins us today to share some of those incredible stories. Let's step out of our villa. Hearing the sound of gentle waves breaking on the soft sand of the beach, we'll look out to sea, spotting the inbound seaplane to the beach. Shaking hands with our pilot and climbing aboard, we'll get going on our Bahamian journey on The Step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay, welcome to On The Step, Paul Harding from Nassau in the Bahamas. Mate, how are you going?
Hey, Daniel. Doing great, mate. I guess we're on a different time zone for sure. I don't know. Even if you're probably on a different day than I am.
It's Wednesday here, and I think it's Tuesday afternoon. Wednesday morning for me, mate. I've got a cup of tea next to me and rubbing my eyes at the moment, just trying to wake up. But I think some of the stories you're about to tell will definitely wake me up from your experiences flying around in the Bahamas. I'm really excited to hear them and have a chat and kind of break that down. Now, I've been following you for a long time, mate, on Instagram and seeing some of the cool photos that you put up on your page around the Bahamas, mate. But I was pretty shocked to hear that that British accent, or what remains of a British accent. There's a bit of Aussie in there, and I'm sure a bit of US in there as well. Can you tell us a little bit about your history, mate, and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, well, as you know, I have to admit that it was a pommy start. I was born in the UK, and my dad came on a contract out with Bahamas Airways here in 1960. So I was brought out here as a wee one, and then going to boarding school, which, you know, the horrendous experience that it was. So when you're surrounded by different accents all the time, I ended up like my dad. You have sort of this international accent. You know, one day you're an Aussie, and the next day you're a little Afrikaans, and then you have to be terribly correct with the English. You know?
Yeah, that's pretty funny. And so where did the seaplane part of it come to, mate? Did you fall in love with seaplanes when you kind of got over to the Bahamas there and just saw how amazing and tropical it was, and you kind of thought, that's what I have to do?
Yeah, well, as I said, my dad was in aviation, so I've been around airplanes since I was a little one at the Farnborough Air Show and things like that. So I always had a fascination with airplanes, but through circumstance and family breakup and all that sort of stuff, I had to start on my own. And starting in aviation on your own is not an easy task if you don't have lots of lolly in the bank. So I ended up actually doing the opposite. I was going down every day. I started a dive business here in the Bahamas, and that's where I met an Aussie partner of mine, and we dove together for years. And then slowly I could build up the capital to, you know, where I could put myself through flight school. So I changed careers literally from going down one day to going up the next. Checked into a Florida flight school. I put myself through all the programs that they had. You know, I mean, I started with a PPL and went through instrument, commercial, and a few miles away over in Central Florida was a seaplane base where they flew Piper Cubs, Jack Brown seaplane base, very famous. A lot of people go through there. And so I got my seaplane rating, and to my mother's shock and horror, before I even set off for flight school, I just walked in the house one day, and she, very perceptive lady, she could understand that there was something adrift. And she asked me, you know, what the hell have I done? What's up? I see something going on here. And I said, well, I've just ordered an airplane. And she said, oh, geez, you know. And she said, ordered? That means new. And I said, yeah, and actually it's a seaplane. And she went, what? And I said, she said, but you don't know how to fly. And I said, I know, I'm going to flight school while they build the airplane, which is what they did. I ordered a brand new mall from the mall factory in Georgia.
Wow. And the intention there was to start a business straight away, was it?
Yeah, I had it in mind to start a commercial seaplane business. There was none here. We have 100,000 square miles of water, 700 islands. And I thought, you know, we could make this work. I'm sure people need to get from A to B. There's only so many land plane runways out there, whereas I could take people, you know, right to the back door, which is what I started to do. But you have to build up hours to get the insurance. So, you know, I flew for a year or so just to build up that insurance time. Once I was insured and I got the license, I got the first seaplane operation in the Bahamas called Safari Seaplanes.
Yeah, wow. And what year was this actually in? Because obviously, you know, there was the Chalks operation that ran some scheduled services out to the Bahamas as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's right. I used to talk to the Chalks boys because we shared the harbor. The Nassau Harbor was my first runway because I was on straight floats. And I had a place where I built a ramp in the harbor. So I used to talk to the Chalks boys every day as we came in. You know, it depended who was coming in first on final. And they had started back, you know, years ago, but I started my operation. I learned to fly in 89, and then about by 1991, we were off and running.
So what was the difference, I guess, between the Chalks operation and what you wanted to do with your little seaplane operation in the Bahamas there?
Well, Chalks was a scheduled airline. You know, see, it was, until they had that awful accident. it was the oldest airline in the world.
Yeah.
And they ran from Florida over to Bimini, the first little island 40 miles off the Florida coast, and then into Nassau. And it was a great service. I mean, we used to just drive across and climb aboard. They had Grumman's and, you know, mallards and widgeons, goose, and we used to fly across to Florida. It was a great way of going across.
And that was your little transport back and forward to do your flight training, was it?
Well, I went over. I ended up staying in Florida for about a month or so doing my PPL. I soloed in 9 hours. And by the time I got my seaplane rating, built a couple of hours, I flew with a buddy of mine who got me into the mall business. We flew back together. I think I barely had 50 hours to my name.
And how big of a flight was that to bring the airplane back to
From Georgia? Where you were? Yeah, it was a long one. It was it's about 2 hours down into Central Florida, another 2.5 here. So, in all, we stopped for fuel in Central Florida. And then from Central Florida, we could make it all the way here. Maul has 4 tanks. She's got tip tanks. So, your bladder doesn't last as long as the fuel.
And did you have the airplane straight away on floats, or was it on wheels at that stage?
No, on floats. Straight away on straight floats.
So you got straight stuck into it and kind of burn around and finding some spots to fly this weapon.
Yep. And it worked out well. I started with the tourism business because when I was in the dive business, that was a commercial dive business, taking tourists out, teaching them how to dive because I'm a licensed instructor. And I thought, if I could make this work the other way, I could take people down to the Keys, which we have a chain of islands called the Exuma Keys. They're about 40 miles out of Nassau, and they go stretch for 120 miles. There's an island for every day, and there's 365 of them in a row.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's really, really beautiful down there. So it's prime seaplane country. And I would take people down there. We would land, go for a swim. There's a place where they shot the James Bond movie, Thunderball, back in 1965. I'd anchor the airplane out off that little island. And then we would all put on snorkeling gear and snorkel in to this island, which is hollow. You can go inside it. And then and feed the fish and all that sort of stuff. People loved it. It was a great trip.
And that was the whole business model at that stage, was it? Just to do just flights to random spots, was it?
It was a day trip, where I could take lunch with us and put a picnic lunch in the floats, coolers, and we could land anywhere and have a spot to eat. And then we would do the cave, and then coming back in the afternoon, I would give them the seagull tour, about 10 feet all the way down the islands, which was a favorite of a lot of people. I met a lot of interesting people that. And from there, from the tourism business, then it got into, you'd see these, we have a lot of these private mega yachts cruising our waters. And these boat captains would approach me somewhere and say, is there any chance you could fly us a bunch of groceries or pick up some guests once in a while? And I said, you bet, that's what we're here for. So the business started just branching out from there, from tourism. It got into the charter business, basically. Tourism was on the side.
I could only imagine, mate, that, with this area and how beautiful it is, that this business would just take off so quickly and you'd be kind of having 4 or 5 planes, shuttling around everywhere. Like, was that ever the case?
It wasn't, only because it was a very, I'm not saying a limited market, but the expense of running an airplane in salt water, anybody who's done it will just, it makes your hair curl at the cost involved and the maintenance. I ended up in my career, I went through like 4 or 5 airplanes. After 3 or 4 years, you end up trading them out or selling them as a project and then buying a new one. It was almost a throwaway airplane.
My first seaplane job was with my dad, and that was in a 206 straight flight seaplane, just doing 15-minute scenic flights. And I saw exactly firsthand what, a seaplane in salt water, how quickly it will degrade if you don't keep on top of things.
Yeah, especially in warm salt water. I mean, you know, we joke about it here. It's like flying in warm battery acid.
Yeah.
We had to do some real protection before they left the factory. We got it down to a pretty good art. My last airplane lasted a long time.
Yeah, that's cool. I haven't actually had anyone on here to talk about or who has flown them all. I mean, they might have flown once or twice, but we haven't actually spoke about them all on this show just yet. So can you tell us a little bit about the aircraft, some specifics, you know, what kind of engine, size and everything?
Yeah, well, it's an amazing airplane. I have to give it credit. I mean, I met the old man, you know, back in the early days. He passed on now. But old B.D. Moore used to sit in the factory in a rocking chair. He had rocking chairs all through the factory. And he'd ride a bicycle from one unit to another to check out the covering, then to check out engines, then to check out door installation. And he would ride all over the place. And, you know, he actually made the Moore famous by flying a tailwheel out of a hangar. He backed it up to the back of the hangar, and then they got photographs of him flying out through the door.
Wow.
So that's how short she was. She could take off, which was perfect for what I wanted. You know, we got these little creeks and places where guys go bone fishing. Very, very tiny little areas, probably, you know, no more than 50 feet wide, and very shallow water, limited distance, trees at the end. So you needed a real small airplane, which it was. And the first one I used was, they all had Lycoming engines, and they all had three-bladed Macaulay props, which I loved. The first one was a 235 Lycoming. And then as I got on later, I went into the 260 injected engine, which was the last one when I went to amphibs. But going from amphibs to straight floats, the mole didn't even feel it. You know, it's a strong beast. It's a good airplane. You have to pay attention.
And did you say it's a fabric covering as well?
Yep. Yeah, it's aluminium or aluminum, as they say over here, wings and fabric fuselage.
That would have helped a fair bit with corrosion control, wouldn't it?
Fabric was great, but you know, it had a steel frame. So we eventually ended up, they started, before they put the covering on, they would fill the frame full of linseed oil and then seal it up. And then they would, you know, try to sell you something called powder coating, which is a waste of time. I eventually told them that I wanted a two-part epoxy paint, which was, that was a success. And I think that's now pretty standard in factory airplanes. And then you put the covering on. But then you have to, you know, you have to spray the interiors with anti-corrosion thing if you're going into salt water. So there's a lot of prep before you take it away from the factory.
Yeah, and what kind of setup was the interior there? Six seats all up, was it?
It was five seats.
Okay.
Pilot, co-pilot, two in the middle, and a rear seat that you could take out for baggage if you didn't have that other person.
Yeah, right. Once again, I just feel like... this should have been a much bigger operation with, like, maybe a caravan or even, you know, a couple of caravans.
Well, that's what it is now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, now once I retired, you know, then a guy came in here with a caravan, but you start charging, you know, $2,200 for a 15-minute flight. I could do it for a quarter of that.
So you're talking about the fellas over there at Tropic Ocean Airways, are you?
Yeah, that Rob I got to know really well. His business took off like a rocket ship.
Hasn't it? Yeah. I've had him on the show, and he's doing a great job there. Obviously, COVID slowing things down as well. So yep. When did you retire, Paul, and how long did you actually have that operation up and running for?
I had it going for about 23 years. And, you know, I banged up about 12,000 plus hours. So I retired, I guess it was about four years ago now.
Yeah.
You know, just one day, here we're under civil aviation rules from the UK. So mandatory 60 years old, you had to call it quits. But
oh, okay.
The guys here knew me, so we worked out an exemption. So I kept going for another 2 or 3 years. Then eventually I'd had enough. I just, you know, I was coming up for a big annual, lots of big expense. I thought, I've done my fair share. I think I'll go play somewhere else.
And do you have a private seaplane in your fleet at the moment?
No, I was over in Europe for a while, in the Mediterranean, and then I was writing the book. When I finished it and published, I came back here, and of course the bug's still there. So I went back to basics and bought a 172.
Oh, cool. And where do you keep that? Just in Nassau as well?
It's out of the FBO, out in Nassau.
So you mentioned the book there, mate. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to put all of your kind of stories into a book and give us a bit of an idea of what kind of stories we can see in that book as well?
Yeah, well, it's my autobiography because I just thought that there's a lot of, you know, well-known Bahamians here who have written their autobiographies, some really interesting folks. We have quite a diverse population here. But a lot of the interesting folks kind of fizzled out into the late 50s and 60s. And I had arrived here in 1960 and nobody's done our generation. So I thought, maybe I'll give it a crack. That's how I started. It was just a journey from A to B through 50 years.
And does it cover a lot of the stories of flying floats around the Bahamas?
Yeah, it's about half, you know, because I had two careers. So the first half is, you know, the survival story of how we were here when we were youngsters. Then getting into the underwater business, I met so many people through that business. One of them was a television producer out of Texas, and he got interested in my photography and what I was shooting underwater. And he asked me to join his team and shoot some shows for the early stages of the Discovery Channel.
Oh, wow.
So I ended up shooting the first shark film on Discovery Channel, which, of course, took off. As you well know, they still have Shark Week all these years. So I shot the first one.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. So then, you know, that's the story goes through there. There's diving with the Aussie. Good God, we got in more trouble than we were worth. Hand-to-hand combat with sharks and swimming with whales in water that was 3 miles deep. And all that kind of stuff. So it's all in there. And then, you know, the bug about seeing a seaplane fly overhead one day and saying, God, I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to have to do it. So that's when I walked in and told Mom I bought an airplane.
What kind of interesting seaplane stories you can share with us out of the book, mate, that you could kind of tell us all now?
Well, let's go fast forward. In the last 3 years, I was Johnny Depp's pilot. He has a private island here. So he used to get off his G5 and stroll across, give me a hug and say, let's get out of here. And I would fly him down to his island.
It's surprising that that some of those high-profile celebrities will kind of actually fly in some small single-engine, you know, seaplanes or even just aircraft in general. You know, mainly because of insurance and stuff like that. He obviously didn't have any issues there at all.
No, he sort of hummed and hawed about it the first time, and I told him, I said, listen, when you're down at your quay, I'll drop in one day, I'll take you for a spin round the block, and then you can tell me how you like it.
Yeah.
We went round his island, pulled up to the beach and said, bloody hell, this is the way to go. That's it.
And how many times did you get to take Johnny around?
Well, quite a bit. As I said, he still owns an island here.
Did you have to put a big skull on the back of the plane, mate, while it was airborne?
No. He was incognito, but his island was flying the Jolly Roger.
Oh, cool. What other stories have you got, mate? I'm sure you got heaps of stories that you could share about your flying history in the Bahamas there.
Yeah, we had some, you know, there's some real hairy moments. You know, we have some interesting weather come through. We're right in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle, so the BBC came out here not long ago and did a show on those of us who were flying in the Bermuda Triangle. But mostly it was really regular work you know, you build that amount of time, you're going to have some oh god moments, which I did have. One of them was the one that was always interesting was after the one of the hurricanes. I think it was after Hurricane Floyd or one of the big hurricanes that comes through here. I start flying the insurance agents, you know, to see the damage. And I had an insurance agent, which I got to know, a real good guy from Scotland. And we were coming out of one island. The wind was blowing pretty good. But the water on the lee side of the island was so flat and so perfect. I said, you know, to hell with taxiing all the way out and getting salt spray all over the airplane. There's only two of us on board. Let's do a run down here on a crosswind takeoff. As I rotated the airplane out, because they came off, you know, more comes off the water very quickly, there was a noticeable bang from the back of the airplane. All of a sudden, the airplane starts to skew. I had reacted so fast to try and correct the skew of losing what felt like I lost rudder control. So I had reacted so fast that I actually broke the opposite rudder pedal.
Wow.
Yeah, just the top of the thing came right off. So now we are headed with no rudder control toward the island because she skews into wind when you lose rudder. And so it's coral rock and bush. And to make it even more interesting, there was an electrical telegraph line running across the top of the hill. You know, what choice do you have? You can't put it in the water. You can't pull the power. So I thought, well, let's see what this mole can really do. And I'm heading towards rock and bush, building up airspeed. And just at the right moment, I give the yoke a yank. And BD Mall, the manufacturer, used to teach us how to pump the flaps, because they weren't electric, they were just on handle. So if you pump the flaps as you pull the yoke back, the airplane can go into a very dramatic climb. And we hopped over everything. My insurance agent looked at me and said, that was a pretty cool piece of flying. So I said, okay, well, we're going back to Nassau now. Let's get ourselves home. There's no point. We can't get stuck out here. We're about 50, 60 miles away from town. So I said, now comes the fun part. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, have you ever tried to land an airplane, especially a seaplane with no rudder? So he goes, oh, crap. So we get into Nassau Harbor, and the only thing I can see is, you know, you can see a wind line coming across the water, which gave me a diagonal shot at the harbor, which is now full of cruise ships and marker buoys for the channels and glass bottom boats and all kind of things. So I'm not only having to do this hairy landing without a rudder, I've got all these objects. It was like flying through a pinball machine. So I pointed into wind, and to cut a long story short, I had to go around twice, and on third time was charm. We touched the water. He said, well, that was brilliant, absolutely great. And I said, yeah, now comes the really fun part, because it involves you. I said, these seaplanes, their rudders are joined and connected to the water rudders. So now we have no steerage on the water, and we need to get back to the shore. So I made him climb out of the airplane and get on his hands and knees facing the water rudders. And I said, when I tell you left, push him left. When I tell you right, push him right. Otherwise, keep him straight. And we're taxiing back across the harbor, and a cruise ship has now left the dock with all the passengers on the rails, watching this seaplane with the strange bloke kneeling on the float, steering us back to shore. So when we get safely back to shore, all I have to do, sure enough, it was a turnbuckle on the rudder horn had given way, which was an FAA-approved part, and which, of course, we changed rapidly to a nautical part. I went to a big marine turnbuckle after that, which the FAA gave me a wink and said, yeah, I like that. And he said, you know, there's one thing about that story, Paul. He said, I'll be sitting in a bar in Scotland, And he said, I won't have to embellish that story at all. So, you know, seaplanes, it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just looking at one of your blogs, mate, on your website, paulhardingadventurestravel.blog. And, you know, there's a list of, you know, you spoke about Johnny Depp there before. There's a list of other celebrities that you've kind of flown around the Bahamas there. Obviously, this is a huge destination for people who... Who want that, you know, exclusive holiday in paradise. Can you share some other stories about, you know, who else you flew around and some of the incredible flights you've done?
Yeah, there's some. I used to fly for a cruise ship line. Some of the cruise ship lines in later years had their own islands. So, you know, having a seaplane operation where they, you know, if there was an emergency or they needed something, they could call us without having to take the cruise ship somewhere else. So, you know, I often had a call of somebody needing an evacuation, a medical emergency. So I lined myself up with an air ambulance out of Florida, used to fly Learjets. So I'd go over to the island that had a lagoon in the middle and I could anchor and we'd get the poor patient on board somehow. I'd fly him over to another island to meet the Learjet on a runway. We could get them in Florida within 2 hours. So, you know, we saved a few lives.
Yeah.
A lot of the celebrities, you know, love to come to these islands because, you know, they don't get bothered by paparazzi and, you know, it's the local Bahamians are very cool towards the people of note, TV and the big screen and that. We just lost Sean Connery. He had a house here. As I used to fly Johnny around, David Copperfield, the magician, he has an island here. Used to fly him as well. So quite a few, you know, and a lot of politicians coming here. Quite a few famous people.
There's another beautiful photo of your airplane on the Water Flying magazine, the Seaplane Pilot Association color magazine they put out. That's a great photo of you, mate. On your phone, on the float there, looking very casual on anchor. That's a great little shot. I love the rego of your airplane as well. C6-Wet Whiskey Echo Tango. couldn't imagine that one was taken up, considering you're one of the only float planes.
I started that here because the Bahamas had we're always a Charlie 6 registration, and then we had the letters afterwards. But they were going alphabetically, just plodding away slowly, slowly through the alphabet.
And what were they at, about Alpha something?
Yeah, they were in the Bravos. It was, you know, okay. Bravo, Foxtrot, Juliet, or whatever it was. Yeah. And I went to civil aviation. I said, no, come on, guys. You know, let's make this a little more exciting. I said, I've got a water plane. We're going to get some good publicity for the islands. I said, I need a good registration. So I said, I'm going to get wet every day of my life, so I got to have wet. And they agreed to it. You know, I paid my $25 or whatever it is they wanted. And after that, of course, then it exploded. Now all the guys have got their own registrations.
Oh, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You see that over here as well in Australia, and I'm sure it happens everywhere else. You know, how often do you see a Cessna Caravan or something like that in the States that's got a 208 in the registration there somewhere, so...
I had C6C as well on another airplane that I own.
Oh, okay, so the different airplanes had different regos that came through. You didn't get them recycled or anything?
Yeah, I kept wet. I transferred that. I stuck with that in the end.
What was it like to actually fly that airplane on the water, mate? You said it was a very short field takeoff and landing aircraft. Did it handle some pretty good chop?
Not big chop, no. I mean, even taxiing in a wind, you know, you get that vortex coming off the propeller, so you can get a lot of splash. You know, wash off later on was quite rigorous. But it was short, so if you did it right, you know, and pointer into wind and make sure you didn't have any curl in the waves, you know, where tide running against the wind, she would get off really quick, and you could land it on a postage stamp. It was amazing. I would come into some places and I could see the passenger next to me sitting there and he'd say, you gonna land there? And I said, sure. And it was done. It was just like a little stream between mangroves, you know, the big pine trees at the end. And it's bloody hell. And I taught Rob's partner, Nick.
Oh, yeah?
I taught Nick how to fly the Maul because they were, when I ended up selling my business, they were going to go into partnership with another guy here. And Nick wanted to learn how to fly the Maul.
How'd he handle it? All good?
Yeah, all good. He couldn't believe it.
So, mate, I just want to jump back to the book as well there, because you know, I think that's an incredible achievement that you've, you know, been able to put together your, you know, autobiography over such a long time, you know, 50 years or so. So it's available on Amazon. I'll put a link in the show notes below as well. It's called Sharks in the Runway, a pilot's chronicle of outrageous adventures, mate. How long did it take to actually put this all together?
Because I was working and I wasn't, you know, plodding away day to day, I had to make a living somehow. So I stretched it out and it probably went, you know, 4 or 5 years. But the hardest part of writing it was the edit, you know, polishing it up. You can write it and bang it out. But then when it comes to, you know, rereading it and editing it and getting everything grammatically correct, I found a publisher who was on both sides of the Atlantic. They were okay, but it was the long and the short of it, the publisher makes the money.
Not the author.
Yeah. But I wanted to leave a legacy in the islands, you know, of what it was like here, what it was like to start your own businesses, the people who I met, the country that I saw from one end to the other. As I said, there's 700 islands. I've seen almost all of them. So it was something that needed to be chronicled. And in this 3 panels of photographs inside the book, because I've got some interesting stuff of, you know, the stuff I used to shoot for Discovery Channel, all the diving I used to do, and the various other locations that we went. So by the time I finished, I think it was it's about 560 pages. It's a bit of a long, slog. The publisher wanted to split it up and say, why don't we just do 2 volumes? And I said, no. This is a journey, and I want, you know, you can always put the book down and go pick it up and continue it later. I said, so it's really one journey, one lifetime, not to be divided up. Nice. So they agreed to it, and it came out pretty good. The reviews on Amazon were very encouraging. It was very gratifying. A lot of good stuff.
That's awesome. Do you know how many books you've sold now? Like, is there some statistics you can follow on that or track or anything?
Yeah, you know, I tried to get that, and I can't get it. They just, you know, they send me a royalty check for what it's worth. You know, didn't even buy the ink and the pen, but it's... I haven't actually seen how many have gone total, but several hundred for sure.
That's good. I like how Johnny Depp's even put a quote in there for you, mate. If the fate had not handed me the path taken, I want to be like Paul. Heck, was that?
That was a fun story. We were Johnny was a great, he's a great down-to-earth guy, and he's been hitting headlines all over the place with strange stuff recently, but... down to earth, you know, he could be sitting here talking with the two of us and he'd be just one of us. He used to invite me for, you know, come and have dinner on the boat. He had his yacht on the quay. And so I'd think, well, there's probably a big to-do, you know, a whole bunch of people. I'd walk on board and it was just his captain, who was a Kiwi and a really nice guy. So it'd be just Graham, Johnny, myself. And the girls would bring us good food and good wine, and we would shoot and swap stories. And he said, I got to tell you one story, he said, because you'll appreciate this, because he knew I was writing, and he encouraged me to write. He said, you really got to finish it. He said, because I was sitting here on the back of the boat with Graham, and he said, we were actually bringing up a conversation. If fate hadn't delivered us the hand that we have now, what would you be doing? And Graham said, well, you go first. And he said, before I could open my mouth, he said, you had obviously spotted us way back up in the Exumas. You were flying down the Exumas, and you came fizzing past the boat at about 10 feet. You know, we were eye to eye with you as you went past at 120 miles an hour and waggled your wings. And he said, I want to be like that guy. So that's how that story came about.
Yeah, right. And what did you say? Did you say, I want to be like Johnny?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I wanted to have his money. Jesus. But, and Sharks in the Runway was an interesting title because I had some clients who I was taking to a private island just out of Nassau, about a 20-minute flight. And where we land, there's a dock, which is a fuel dock for the yachts. And I pull into a beach adjacent to that. And there's a fish cleaning station there. And guys were cleaning fish, and throwing mahi carcasses into the water. So there's a huge squadron of sharks swimming around, mostly nurse sharks, a few lemons. So as I land there, and I'm now taxiing past the station, and I guess the sharks see this thing coming through the water, the floats, and so they're swimming underneath the airplane. And the person behind me in the back says, oh, shit. He said, there's sharks in the runway. So I turn around and said, thank you. Now I've got the title of my book now.
That's awesome. It's funny, where I fly to in the Kimberley, we pull up onto our fuel raft there at Kirri Bay, and there's all these, I think they're very similar, like the kind of lemon sharks or sleepy sharks or whatever they are.
Right.
They all follow around the aircraft tender that comes out from the dock at the right. Little pearl farm there, and then, you know, you're refueling, and every now and again there'll be shark that comes up, swims under the mallard there, and you know, it's just cruises around. They're beautiful to watch, but I think the one I had that was most interesting was I was at Whitehaven Beach in the Whitsundays. Very similar, not as, you know, it's one of the best beaches in Australia, probably the best, but that area is very similar to the Bahamas, I guess, or Australia's closest equivalent. And I was getting airborne in a Beaver, and was on the step, and about 500 meters in front of me, I reckon, I saw a humpback whale right in front of me, just you know, not a breach, but just coming out of the water there and just shooting out the breath of air out the top there. And I was already on the step pretty good, so I knew I'd get airborne well before it, but I got airborne and kind of said to everyone, look, just have a look at the left window, everyone. And I couldn't avoid kind of going over it that close. But he went straight over the top of this humpback whale at the end of the runway. So it's pretty interesting what kind of animal life you can encounter as a seaplane pilot.
Yeah, I mean, there's always an object. My object in the runway was probably a 300-pound loggerhead turtle. I was just coming down, just for touchdown, and he came up for air right in front of me. It would have been like hitting a boulder in the water.
Exactly.
So I just hopped over the top of him and then put it down again. But he was big. He was probably 6 feet long.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Paul, it's been awesome kind of hearing some stuff about your history and talking a little bit about the book as well. Hopefully people can jump onto the show notes link in the bottom of this episode and have a look at the book and maybe grab a copy. There's also an excerpt there as well, isn't there, that people can have a quick read for themselves before they buy it?
Yeah, it's anybody who likes the outdoors and, you know, a crazy life, you know, some of the stuff that we did and sit down later and go, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm still alive. But it's got some good stuff in there, and it was worth putting it on paper. I'm glad. I appreciate it. It was nice talking with you.
Awesome. Well, we're not finished yet, mate. Just before we jump into the end there, I like to finish with this splash and dash questionnaire. It's basically a little bit of a rapid fire question for the end of the show here. I think I know the answer to this one as well, the first question, but what's been your favorite seaplane that you've ever flown?
I got to say the Mall M7 260 on amphibious floats.
Takes the cake, does it?
Takes the cake.
Awesome. you've got lakes, rivers, open ocean, or even those beautiful coral caves in the Bahamas there. Where has been your favourite place to land the Maul or any other seaplane that you've flown?
As I said earlier, I think I got to say the Exuma Keys. If you go online, if you find my blog, there's some sites there that will just take your breath away. So we don't have any rivers in the Bahamas, so we have no pollution in the water. It's just crystal clear with the most amazing color. So flying over it, let alone landing in it, is amazing.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. And the photos are impressive, so make sure you check those out.
Yeah.
What about a seaplane you haven't flown yet? What would be your dream seaplane to fly?
Oh, that's a good one. When I was up in British Columbia, you mentioned a Beaver, and the guy found out that I was a commercial pilot, and we had to fly down the coast of British Columbia, and he said, I got some paperwork to do. Any chance you could just take it down there? It's just follow the shoreline. So I did fly a Beaver that once, but yeah, the Beaver would be a rip.
Those were the days, weren't they? Hey, just like, oh, you're a pilot, are you? Okay, no worries. I'm just going to do some paperwork while you fly us down. Just keep the island on the left and the ocean on the right, we'll be right.
That's it.
What about any other cool dream seaplane jobs? It sounds like you had an absolute ripper of a seaplane job, but what about, is there anything else out there around the world that you've kind of spotted and been like, that'd be a cool seaplane job?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think I was spoiled rotten by creating what I did where I did. I was just at the right place, right time. I've seen some seaplane operations down in the Maldives and stuff. I think they have twin otters over in the Far East. I think they've even got them in Dubai now. But I think here is really hard to beat, I'll be honest with you. I know Rob flies in here once in a while, and all the guys really love to. It knocks the spots off anything. I did a lot of other flying, but I think this one takes the cake. It's hard to beat.
I think so. It sounds like, especially when I was looking at your blog, mate, and saw a few photo shoots with some supermodels on the beaches there. That's pretty hard to do. Pretty hard to beat as well. I was lucky enough to do a Sports Illustrated shoot at Whitehaven Beach one very early morning for about 4 hours. Don't know what happened to the seaplanes. They drifted off somewhere, but was very entertained on the beach. That's for sure.
That's rough work. That was really rough work when you got to work with that. You have to do a shoot for Victoria's Secrets. Oh gosh. Now.
Yeah, where are those photos on the blog, mate?
Oh, well, that's another book, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. What about if you could choose any seaplane to fly around the world in, what would be the most ideal seaplane?
Wow, that's a hell of a question. There's a guy here who flies for a private island, who flies a caravan. But he took one of my clients we lost him a couple of years ago. He passed away. Mr. McTaggart was a Canadian millionaire who had a couple of islands here. And he took his pilot, my buddy, Glenn, and they flew around the world in a goose. So I think that would be the choice.
Yeah, I think any of the Grumman products would be pretty epic. Yeah. The Mallard, the Goose, or even the Albatross. Albatross, I think, would be incredible, especially kitted out with some beds and, you know, big lounges in the cabin space there.
Yeah, I think that's what Buffett had. Buffett dropped in one day. He saw me on a beach, and I'm sure it was an Albatross. He gave me a circle and dropped in and came ashore in a dinghy and said, good day.
And a fellow seaplane pilot, hello.
Yeah, hello. There's a few of us around.
Yeah, that's the go. What about the ideal seaplane to take out on a Sunday afternoon? The Maul?
Yeah, I mean, have you ever flown one? I mean,
I haven't, mate. No.
It's an amazing beast to fly. I mean, it's got all the guts, all the power, and it's comfy. You know, I'm 6'2", and I fit okay inside it. I even got Tyler Perry in it once, and he's 6'4", 6'5". You know, he's touching the headliner. But everybody who flew in that airplane always loved it, always was very impressed in its performance. I've not flown an airplane that can outperform them all.
Yeah, wow. And finally, mate, what about some advice for anyone aspiring to maybe start their own business, you know, running a seaplane? In, you know, that's what I guess I've got out of your stories, kind of jumping out on off a ledge and kind of going for it. Have you got any advice for anyone who would kind of want to start up a business like the one you've done?
Yeah, it takes a bit of fortitude, and but I can absolutely recommend it, you know, in hindsight. But I did, I just, as I said, I took the plunge. And, you know, I started from scratch. I ordered an airplane, and I had never flown an airplane before. So that was a bit unusual. But it was a hell of a way to meet fantastic people. I always remember a good buddy of mine saying, once I was getting into aviation, he said, I'll tell you one thing. He said, aviation will change your life. And he was right. I met some of the most amazing people, saw amazing things all through flying. So I would definitely tell people, go for it. It's hard with a seaplane operation because you're dealing with insurance, which is mandatory for a commercial operation. So you have to build those hours. So be prepared for some expense and a bit of a grunge to get those hours, to get find an insurance company who will cover you. You have to do some research before you take that plunge.
Good advice, mate. Well, Paul Harding, it's been awesome hearing some of your stories from your career in the Bahamas there, and I'd like to thank you very much for coming on The Step.
Oh, it was a pleasure, man. It was nice meeting you, and here we are from the Bahamas to Australia. It's amazing. Technology is a real, real good thing these days. And it was a real pleasure. Thank you, mate.
Thanks very much, Paul. Cheers.
All right. Take care.
And that's the show for today, folks. Thanks, Paul, for the great chat, and I can't wait to get my hands on his book to have a read. Now is the time, folks, to jump on Apple Podcasts, share a very merry review, and tell someone about this episode. This week, I challenge you to share this episode with someone who loves the Bahamas. That should be everyone. Next episode, I am joined by an Alaskan pilot who doubles as a seaplane instructor. Once again, folks, I hope everyone out there has had a very merry Christmas, and until next time, thanks for coming on The Step.